This is The Creative Way on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. The oldest orchestra west of the Mississippi premiered in 1896 as the Portland Symphony. By 1929, it was considered one of the finest orchestras in the country, one that now was reaching a wider audience with national radio broadcasts. In 1967, the name was changed to the Oregon Symphony, followed by performances around the state, from Klamath Falls to Coos Bay to the Dalles. In 1980, orchestra leaders envisioned another milestone, and to help them accomplish it, they enlisted conductor James DePriest, who had refused to let his polio keep him from prestigious appointments around the world. That era is a central part of the new memoir by Jeanette DePriest, Reach Up, My Beautiful Journey with James DePriest. I sat down with Jeanette in her Portland apartment recently to hear how the symphony's hiring committee gave her late husband an offer he couldn't refuse. They gave him a mission if he chose to accept it, and that was to elevate the orchestra from the status of regional to national, and which involved jumping through a lot of hoops for the American League of Orchestras.
Yeah. Well, a regional orchestra consists of local budgeting. I mean, whether it's the state government, the city, or the good heart of supporters, that doesn't go any further than that, because there's no such ranking that will force musicians, which are professional in their own right, to have a steady job. Mm-hmm. It's part-time. Being a national symphony or an orchestra requires the standard base for paying your musician. So that was a big step. Also, it required those who had regular job to let go of that, because it meant rehearsing during the day. And also, it meant that by increasing a budget, you would attract better musicians, and you would attract better soloists as well. So all of those hurdles were to be met.
Right.
And that was a big challenge.
It caused some soul-searching among the musicians, because they had to give a higher level of commitment. And it also raised just the day-to-day process, because prior to becoming national, the rehearsal space itself had terrible acoustics. Isn't that right?
Absolutely.
It was different than performance, which any musician knows you want to rehearse where you're performing.
Yeah. Although there's still a lot of that kind of system going on around the world. But usually those rehearsal rooms are designed for those orchestra, which was not the case in Portland.
Right.
It was a facility that housed pretty much all the roadshow and everything else, so it was not meant to be rehearsed there. So when the musician would get on stage before performing, they had to reinvent the wheel, because the sound around them was different. So it meant a big challenge, yeah.
He was a driving force behind it. I know you helped as well.
Yes.
To get into the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So was that an easy path?
No. Portland love its comfort. They are not necessarily aiming at something always bigger. They always think that's good enough for us. And Jimmy was determined to have a better situation with the Oregon Symphony. So he presented that project to the city council. Some commissioners were for it, some were not, and with a very strong group of supporters with the symphony. And the power that be at the time, they gathered and they were able to pass an ordinance that provided the Oregon Symphony and the city funding to occur, so that the Schnitzer Hall, which was aimed to be demolished at the time, it was a Paramount Theater, and
right.
and the hotel next to it as well. So that revived this whole section of the city, and it became what it is today.
Where the new building is near the Oregon Historical Society.
Exactly.
And the Portland
and
Art
it's
Museum.
It's now named the Art District. That's really wonderful to see how it really has evolved and remained alive in spite of all the hurdle that we had in them.
Thanks to some visionary individuals.
Exactly.
So James led the Oregon Symphony for 23 years,
mm-hmm.
and in that time they did a number of tours.
Yes.
And you were usually at his side. So what are some memories that stand out to you as highlights, that especially ones that you've written in the book?
Well, there was one in particular that I just kept in my mind all those years. And we were touring in one of the cities was Klamath Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up in this auditorium in a college somewhere. And I was sitting on the seat close to the end of a row. And just before the concert started, there was a mother who showed up with her two girls. One was very young, I would say 3 or 4, and the other was 5 or 6. But the 5 or 6 year old was mentally and physically handicapped. And as soon as the orchestra started tuning, she hummed the way those young, you know, yes, those young patients can do. And her mother, she said, she loves music. And I said, okay, that's great. And she just would, and the orchestra was just tuning. There was no sound really, but she was really happy. And she got agitated and she said, maybe I should go. I said, no, why should you? And in the same moment, a couple in the back of us commented on the fact that it was horrible that this woman would bring her children to a concert, especially with a crippled one. And that at that time, she got up. I said, you sit down, you give me that lovely little girl of yours, I'm going to sit her on my lap, and we're going to listen to a lovely concert together. And I said, there's no intermission, there's nothing, it's going to be short and sweet, and we're going to have a good time. And sure enough, as soon as Jimmy started, she just calmed down. She was singing a little bit, but she fell asleep. And the concert went on, and at the end, obviously, people were clapping. So she woke up immediately, and she was agitated. And I put her little two hands between mine, and we clapped together. And I turned around, and I looked at the mother, and she was crying. She said to me, it is the best time I had ever since that child was born. Oh. So I took that upon myself because I have a niece in that same situation. My brother's first child was profoundly handicapped. Mm. And all that time I was just thinking of Genevieve. That's her name.
Okay.
And I was just profoundly touched by that. So at the end of the concert, we were backstage, and Jimmy was asking, he said, what was this little racket at the beginning of the performance? And I told him the story. And he said, honey, this made my day. So that was a very memorable day for me.
I love that you stood up for basically disability rights before they became mainstream. That's nowadays, right. Big venues in San Francisco and Portland, they have dedicated special needs concerts where kids like that can run around or make noise. You know, it's more inclusive now.
True. Hopefully it will stay that way.
This is The Creative Way on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. My guest is Jeanette DePriest, author of Reach Up, My Beautiful Journey with James DePriest. The memoir details the 30 years of her marriage to DePriest, whom she met when he came to do a radio interview at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, where she was a producer. You write that one of his signature pieces was Sergei Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2. This is one of the many recordings that Jimmy did with the Oregon Symphony. This is from the album The Sea and the Gulls, James DePriest and the Oregon Symphony. This is from 1987. Here's Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2 in E minor, the third movement, the Adagio. Music at its best. Does this bring anything up for you? What kind of memories come up for you when you hear this that he conducted so often?
I have a little secret for you. I have a hard time listening to his music. It swells up in me.
Yes.
Because I was there from studying the score at the rehearsal, following mm-hmm. all the notes and letting him know everything, to the recording session where I was in the booth with him. And the fact that the Rachmaninoff Symphony is truly a signature piece.
Yes.
Everybody will recognize Jimmy as Rachmaninoff master, I guess.
Yes.
So it is always emotional. I'm getting better, but it's it's still very difficult. I would drive, for example, and listen to a classical station, and I can tell you in a second that it's Jimmy conducting. So I have to park and just listen to it so I won't be, you know, fogging the windows of my car when I drive.
Is there something distinctive that you can hear that you recognize?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you were a classical music lover before you met Jimmy. It became the center of your life, at the center of your life, along with him. It's such a profound shift.
Yeah, I was a classical lover, but on a totally different sphere. Mm. My father was a choir master. Mm. So most of the music I grew up listening to were music from church choir and oratorio and things like that in the period of Bach. But because I work in a radio station, we had incident of music and recordings and things like that that got me into that realm of music, and I fell in love with it immediately.
So you were primed, really?
Yeah, I was.
What did this life you shared together, this beautiful life, end up meaning for you, the role that you played in each other's lives?
I like to tell my friends that I was the bright light in the shadow. By profession, I was always in the booth. I never was in front of the microphone. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I loved the perspective it gave us. Also, the sense of focusing on what's coming when the other person on the other hand, which was in front of the microphone, didn't necessarily see coming.
Okay.
So I always had that sense of following whatever was happening. And in Jimmy's life, I was like that as well. You know, I was at the rehearsal. He would ask me, what did you think? I would say the trumpets are a little too loud, or we're losing the cello, or something like that, because of my training as a radio producer. So that was fun. Mm. I really always enjoying being in the shadow of people, because I could see them shine better.
Yes, you felt useful.
Exactly. And my life with Jimmy was basically that. And I loved it. People were saying, don't you miss it? I said, no, I got promoted.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Lastly, your book, which is so wonderfully put together, it really is a charming read. It's just full of interesting anecdotes, even for the non-music lover, you know, so-called music lover. It's just a very interesting account. And one thing that I liked is that you've framed it, each chapter you framed with a poem of Jimmy's. He was a published poet, and I'd like to have you read a poem or two.
Oh my goodness, what an honor. Well, let me just...
Let's do him proud.
Okay. There is something about this poem that always touches me, and you'll understand. I mean, you are right now in my apartment. Mm-hmm. You know I'm in downtown Portland. You know I'm very close to OHSU.
Yes.
Therefore, we've been lucky so far. There's no sirens in our conversation.
Right.
But I'll read you a poem that I love.
Okay.
My grandmother brought the distant siren's tension among the peace of our unaffected home, with word that spoke the compass of her soul, and never let us untouch, hear a siren's song again. Poor somebody, she said.
Yeah. Jeanette, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me, and good luck with your book.
Thank you so much for coming.
You've been listening to The Creative Way and the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. My guest was Jeanette DePriest, author of Reach Up, My Beautiful Journey with James DePriest. James passed away in 2013, and the memoir details how the Oregon Symphony evolved under his 23 years of leadership, as well as key moments with his mentor Leonard Bernstein, his aunt Marian Anderson, and others. You can hear more episodes of The Creative Way at jeffexchange.org, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.